Longtime readers of the New York Times appreciate a lot about the paper. Here's one thing that I appreciate, the obituaries. The Times chronicles the lives of the famous and infamous, the well-known, and those who should have been better known. The Times' William McDonald has pulled some of the most interesting obituaries together in a new book, The Socialite Who Killed a Nazi with Her Bare Hands, and 143 other fascinating people who died this past year. And Bill McDonald joins us now. Bill, good morning.
Good morning.
With a title like that, I've got to ask about Nancy Wake. She's a socialite who killed a Nazi with her bare hands, and her story reads like a novel. Who was she, Bill?
Well, she was exactly that, and in fact, she was something out of a Hemingway novel.
No kidding.
As the obit says. But she was a woman who was born in 1912 in New Zealand, grew up in poverty, but managed to find her way to Europe, where she wanted to just live the life, and she did. She became a freelance journalist, and she was became something of a belle of Paris. Got involved, mingled with, hobnobbed with high society, and actually married an industrialist which made her, in fact, a socialite. The other side of her story, of course, the most interesting part is that she became involved in the French Resistance, and she had actually been to Vienna. She saw Nazi gangs beating Jewish men and women in the street just randomly, and was so appalled.
And she hated Nazis as a result, right?
And she hated them. She said, "My hatred of the Nazis was very, very deep." And so she went back to France, and she got involved in the resistance movement, helped airmen who were downed in France, help them escape across the border. She did, in fact, strangle a Nazi with her bare hands, a German sentry. She was involved in espionage and sabotage. She was smuggling guns to the French resistance. She dropped behind enemy lines at D-Day, parachuted in with the British. So it's just an extraordinary tale of a woman who probably wasn't well known until she died. She got a lot of attention then because she had this amazing story.
Yeah, I love one of the lines in this obituary of Nancy Wake. She was once asked about her private life, and she said that she never had any affairs, and she regretted that. What a great line.
yeah. She was quite a character throughout her life. She was a font of some good lines, even in the obit.
Who did she kill with her bare hands, Bill?
Well, she never identified him. She said it was a German sentry. We don't have a record of it, but this is her claim. And the military records seem to bear it out, but we don't have names of the victim in that case.
How does the Times manage to track down people you want to write an obituary about, but maybe who aren't that well known? How do you figure out who you want to chronicle?
Well, we're told by people who know them. We're alerted to their deaths through email, phone calls. We look at every day we have a meeting. We look at that day's list of candidates. And we do the necessary legwork and research. We do due diligence on everyone who comes our way. We check them out. We look for their to see if their story holds up. Sometimes claims are a little inflated. Other times they're right on. And so we then make a decision based on how significant that person's life was, what kind of impact they had, whether they were involved in a moment in history like Nancy Wake. Or maybe an inventor of something that really changed the way we live, that kind of thing. We do the research and we talk to people, and sometimes we'll come away saying, no, I don't think we're going to do this one. The story doesn't quite hold up. So we'll sometimes make that decision too.
We're talking with William McDonald. He's with the New York Times. His new book, The Socialite Who Killed a Nazi with Her Bare Hands, and 143 other fascinating people who died this past year. How much time will you allow to pass after a death, and you'll still write an obituary about somebody? How much maximum time can you let pass?
Well, our rule of thumb is roughly a month, 30 days. Mm. But it's very fluid. It depends on when we hear of the death, too. Sometimes people will not report a death publicly for days or even weeks. In the case of Edwin Newman, who worked for NBC, you might recall, and wrote books on language.
Oh, sure.
His family didn't report his death until about a month after he had died.
Why not?
The story was that they wanted to have time to mourn him privately. They just didn't want to have to deal with the wider world. And so they actually waited. He had been buried, and they waited. A month later, we could now finally report it. So in a case like that, you know, they dictated when we were going to be writing about him. But generally, though, sometimes people will wait a day or two or more, and then we have to start the research and reporting. And so it could be a week out before we actually have the obituary in the paper. So sometimes the dates you'll look at the date and say, why is this appearing now when the person died 2 weeks ago? Well, many times we only just heard about it.
I assume in some cases you're writing your obituaries ahead of time.
We write a lot ahead of time. We have about 1,500 on file.
Really? And
that pile is growing all the time. It's a small fraction of all those we'd like to have, but, you know, we only have so many hands. But we do as many as we can. It's necessary, frankly, for particularly the more important, famous people who are going to be, as soon as they die, it's big news, and the website, which is now a 24/7 operation, you know, wants the story right away, and or we want to get into the paper right away. So it's the more we can do in advance, the better we are, better off we are.
You know, how awkward is it for an obituary writer to call the family or close friends of someone who's prominent, and even though that person may not have died yet, and say, "Hey, I'm with the New York Times obituary desk. We're preparing an obituary on this person." I imagine that can be awkward at times.
It's very awkward, to be honest, and it's delicate. We have to be sensitive. We just don't call people out of the blue and tell them that. We often will, if we're going to do something in advance and we think we want to talk to the individual, and many people do want to talk to us. They want to have a word, a part of their own obit, in a sense. But often we'll go around them. We might find a family member or an associate or someone like that who might feel it out for us and see if that person would be amenable. Sometimes not. Sometimes they're horrified by the idea. Other times, though, as I say, sometimes you'll get people who are very eager. They understand that we do this, and they may have things they want to say. And we've had many cases like that where we've had interviews with people. And then, lo and behold, a month or two later, they actually did die. And we have an interview that never before published.
What's the challenge of pulling together a good obit, Bill?
It's probably getting the facts correct, you know, because lives are so complicated and there's such detail in them. One of the big obstacles is just making sure we're factually accurate, making sure we're not missing anything. Some individuals may not want us to know about certain aspects of their lives, and so we, you know, particularly if they're not public figures, where pretty much everything's on the record. So we try to be complete. We don't like to omit things. So it's a combination of being accurate, making sure all bases are covered, and then, you know, writing it in a graceful way. I mean, in a way that really draws a reader in.
Again, our guest is William McDonald. He's the obituaries editor for the New York Times. Tell us about Arch West, the man who invented Doritos, who passed away in the last few months.
Yeah, he didn't invent Doritos, actually, what he did was he had the sense to recognize something that might sell. So he was a good marketing man. He was a marketing vice president for Frito-Lay, and he was out of Dallas, and he was on a family vacation in San Diego, and this was back in the early 60s. And so they pull into a roadside stand. They're selling Mexican food, Mexican-American stand with, you know, burritos and that kind of thing, tacos, and he notices that they're selling this fried corn chip, not like a Frito, something different, a little triangle with a coating of spice and cheese, and he tries it, and he goes, this is great, I love this, maybe we could sell this, there's a market here, and he brings it back to Dallas, and he introduces it to his people there, and they run with the idea. So he didn't so much invent, we'll probably leave that to some anonymous cook in a roadside stand, but he had the smarts to bring it to the public.
There's another World War II hero I wanted to ask you about that's in this book. The saboteur who posed as a nun, his name is Robert Jean-Marie de la Rochefoucauld. Did I say that right?
You did. Very good. Very good. It's a quite musical name, too, I think. He was another character, a true-to-life character who had a story similar to the socialite who killed a Nazi with her bare hands. He, in fact, was an aristocrat born in France, came from a long line of French aristocrats, but did become very, very active in the French resistance and became famous as this saboteur par excellence. He was a sort of a Houdini, could constantly find ways to escape captors. I mean, he was planting bombs, he was blowing up bridges and that kind of thing, installations, but he, in one case, escaped on a bicycle dressed as a nun, which is where the title headline came from. Hmm. Another time he was he saw a Nazi limousine unoccupied but with the keys in the ignition, and he stole that to get out of town. And so he just had this very intrepid, spectacular life that could easily be a movie. Hmm. But again, it's something you couldn't make up.
You know, that generation obviously is passing by the day, but boy, there are stories from those days that even for me today are just absolutely riveting, because I just almost can't imagine myself in the same position, I guess.
Yeah. That's true. There are lives that you might have, you wish you could live, or you had the moxie that they did. I mean, that's one of the things I learned from reading about them, is that these were people who really did things with their lives and took risks and were sort of fearless and made contributions, but lived it to the full, lived it to the hilt.
How about the man who brought mini golf to the masses? His name was Ralph J. Loma.
Right. He was a guy from he actually had a miniature golf. In the early days of miniature golf, it was kind of a sedate, greens with holes in them, and mainly used by other golfers. He decides to make it a family event, bring the kids kind of place. And so he introduces moving windmills and spouting whales and, all the things that you see in miniature golf. Mm-hmm. And it did become a kind of a family. He made it a family entertainment, a place you could bring your date, if you're a teenager. And so, he just did something in a small way that changed our culture, and we love that kind of story.
Yeah, absolutely. You also write about the life of William Hamilton, the theologian who asked a question that rocked a lot of people, and that question was, is God dead?
Yeah, story that we're familiar with. Perhaps if you're of a certain age, you might remember the Time magazine cover.
I do,
With that very question, is God dead? And probably the most famous Time magazine cover. He was part of this whole movement that was provoking this question, and he was misunderstood because he wasn't proposing that God did not exist. He wasn't an atheist. He was actually a man of the cloth, a theologian with a devout churchgoer, but he had a different view on the role and the place of God in modern society, and that's what he was talking, that the world had to think of God in a different way, not as the medieval Christians did, but as something more modern. And so anyway, he was vilified for it, lost his job in one university. Hmm. And so it's a story, both a story of ideas, but also a story of the consequences, that radical ideas or unconventional ideas might have.
Well, Bill, I'm a big fan of the obituaries page for your newspaper, and really appreciated you taking some time with us today.
Okay.
All the best
appreciate
to you.
Appreciate being here. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
That's New York Times obituaries editor William McDonald. His new book, again, is The Socialite Who Killed a Nazi with Her Bare Hands and 143 Other Fascinating People Who Died This Past Year. You can find more information about our broadcasts at kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date. Tomorrow we're warming up with some good stories as the book doctors stop by with their recommendations for your good wintertime reads. Also, we'll introduce you to our new series, 90 Mile View. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, and Beth Lipoff. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.